This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Your headlines for this hour: the death toll from Israel's genocide in Gaza tops 22,400 as the regime continues to pound the territory's healthcare facilities. Iran's president vows a decisive punishment for those involved in the recent terrorist attack in Kerman, saying there will be no safe haven for them. And the Islamic resistance in Iraq carries out fresh attacks on two bases housing the occupied American forces in eastern Syria. Thank you for joining us. Today's top story: the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on Gaza enters its fourth month as the regime in Tel Aviv keeps pounding the blockaded territory with airstrikes and artillery fire. In the latest development, an Israeli airstrike targeted the European hospital in Khan Yunis, south of Gaza, killing at least one Palestinian and injuring several others. In the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza, five Palestinians were killed and several others were injured as Israeli forces targeted a vehicle. The death toll in Gaza has already surpassed 22,400, mostly women and children, since October the 7th. More than 57,000 have also been injured. According to UN estimates, the deadly onslaught has also displaced nearly 2 million people.
There are now nearly 1.9 million displaced across the Gaza Strip. Among them are 1.4 million in 155 shelter centers or UNRWA schools, and there are around 500,000 in other locations.
Abu Hasna added that most of Gazans are being pushed to Rafah, which can only accommodate 250,000 Palestinians. He said this is while there are around 1.3 million people in Rafah living in dire conditions. The UNRWA official warned the health and environmental conditions are facing a major collapse. This, as Gaza health sector has been largely under Israeli relentless bombardment since the beginning days of the war. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society has urged international community's intervention to protect Al Amal Hospital as well as its premises and staff. Palestinian resistance fighters have launched fresh attacks against Israeli forces in retaliation for the regime's deadly bombings across the Gaza Strip. Al-Ghassan Brigade says it has targeted gatherings of Israeli forces in several parts of the besieged territory. They say their latest operations have caused casualties amongst the invading Israeli troops. The resistance fighters have also hit a number of military vehicles, including a Merkava tank. Meanwhile, the Al-Quds Brigade, the military wing of the Islamic Jihad movement, says it has targeted two military vehicles in eastern Al-Buraij camp in central Gaza Strip. The Israeli regime says over 170 of its forces have been killed in Gaza since the ground invasion began on October 27th. The resistance groups, however, say the regime is underreporting its casualties. From Deir al-Balah in Gaza, our correspondent Muti al-Musabeh joined us earlier for more on the latest Israeli attacks on Gaza.
Israeli attacks are still prevalent on all areas of Gaza Strip. However, these attacks are still intensified in the central area of Gaza Strip, where the latest attack targeted a civil car, claiming the lives of two Palestinian civilians in addition to dozens of the Palestinian injuries. That attack actually was carried out by a fighter drone. A couple of moments ago, the Israeli artillery resumed its shelling towards the Palestinian residential areas here in the surrounding areas of Gaza Strip. And actually, this kind of the escalating Israeli attacks against the central area of Gaza Strip pushed more Palestinian families taking shelter here in the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital to flee the area into the south. It is noticed recently that the Israeli occupation forces effectively use the fighter drone, particularly the quadcopter drones, which are qualified and well-equipped to attack the Palestinian civilians in the streets, as they are equipped with multiple rifles, let me say. So we are witnessing that dozens of the Palestinian injuries and the Palestinian casualties brought to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, they were attacked by those quadcopters, fighter drones used by the Israeli occupation forces. Hundreds of thousands of the Palestinian people taking shelter in the department of Al-Quds University near Al-Maghazi refugee camp. They entirely were demanded by the Israeli occupation forces to evacuate and to go to Deir el-Balah city and to Rafah city, claiming that these areas are safe. However, the Israeli airstrikes and the Israeli attacks are still maintained against these areas.
Persian Gulf nations joined the chorus of global condemnation against the comments by Israeli officials calling for the immigration of Gaza's residents and the re-establishment of Israeli settlements in the Palestinian territory. Saudi Arabia categorically denounced and rejected the remarks made by far-right Israeli ministers Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich. Riyadh called on the international community to act against Israel's persistent violation of international law. Qatar also condemned in the strongest terms Israel's policy of collective punishment and forced displacement of Palestinians. The UAE also categorically decried and rejected the extremist remarks. Kuwait also warned against such plan. The United States, France and the European Union have also denounced the comments. UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk emphasized that the international law prohibits the transfer of protected persons within or deportation from an occupied territory. Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by the man himself, Mr. Jim Kavanaugh, political analyst and blogger. Now, Mr. Kavanaugh, your opinion, or what do you think of what Smotrich or Ben-Gvir have been saying? They've been advocating what they call voluntary migration, which many Palestinians and rights group analysts, critics see as forced displacement and the renewal of illegal settlements in the enclave.
Yes, this is a voluntary immigration is a euphemism. You know, it's not voluntary when you're starving and dying. And this is the problem, you know. It's not just Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. It's the whole Israeli government. It's the Israeli Jewish people. They're all for this. Netanyahu is having conversations with countries, the Congo, about taking in Gazan refugees. The American government is going to get behind this. American politicians are putting forward proposals in the Congress to condition American foreign aid on countries taking in Gazan refugees. This is going to be presented as the humanitarian answer, the peaceful it's not a forced transfer. It's voluntary. The people of Gaza will have a choice whether to go or not. They will have a choice whether to sit and allow themselves to die, because they are dying by being killed by American bombs wielded by Israel, or a half a million. UN and international agencies are saying a half a million Gazans will die of disease, and a half a million Gazans will die of hunger over the next year. So if you're a Gazan family and you're offered the opportunity to leave and go to Canada, who's going to stop you? This is going to happen. I'm really afraid. All these statements, UN resolutions, Arab country revolution, I don't care who it is, Iran, Saudi Arabia, they say we're against it, it's bad, the United States says it's bad, they're going to do it. And they're going to cajole and bribe countries and countries like Canada will stand up and say, I'll take 50,000 Gazans. You don't have to bribe them, they'll do it. Germany, they took the Syrian refugees, we'll take the Gazan refugees. And Gazan families will start to go because they have no other alternative. Really, the only way to stop this is by an intervention that includes armed force, that brings humanitarian, a flotilla of humanitarian aid with armed escort by countries like Russia, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Iran, if they can, but they're in a difficult situation with this, but, and coming in with humanitarian aid and saying, we're bringing in ships with doctors and food and construction equipment, and we're going to come in and rebuild, and we're not going to take the anesthetics out of our, the Israelis are not going to be able to take what they want out of our thing. We're going to go in and rebuild, and if you try to stop us, we will fight you. That is the only way this is going to stop, because in a few months, I'm going to tell you, there'll be tens of thousands of Gazans leaving. There'll be five or six countries that'll start. And who's going to stop it? Nobody is doing anything to stop this.
Mr. Kavanaugh, is it fair to say that from the beginning, the Israeli regime's plan was to displace the Palestinians from the north to the south, as they said, safe places, safe areas, but they're getting bombed all the time, day and night. So displace them to the south and then bomb them there, so force them to leave South Gaza to maybe the Sinai Desert, maybe to Egypt?
I mean, look, it's clear now that that's the plan. They said it. Now, some of them said it. Now they're saying it out loud, okay? That was the plan. The Israeli plan in Gaza was never to eliminate Hamas. They know they can't do that. As long as the Palestinians are there, there'll be Palestinian resistance. But you get rid of the Palestinians, it doesn't make any difference if Hamas is fighting or PFLP is fighting. That has no point. And they're going to get rid. They got rid of 80% of Palestinian Arabs in 1948, and created a fait accompli that the world accepted. From their point of view, this is part of the same project. They want to get rid of 80% of the Gazans. That's always been, obviously, what they're doing here is destroying the possibility of life in Gaza and creating conditions in which the Gazans will want to leave, and then they're going to create avenues for them to leave. That's been the point the whole time. That's the main objective in Israel, of Israel and Gaza, and they are succeeding in it. And it does. Hamas hitting tanks is not going to stop them. Hamas is doing a great job. The resistance is doing a great job, but they are not going to stop this from happening. It's going to take international intervention with armed force to go in with humanitarian aid without Israeli permission and rebuilding and starting to rebuild the possibility of life for Gazans, or else in a few months, Israel would be a pariah state. They'll have all kinds of court resolutions and UN resolutions against them, and the Gazans will be leaving.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Kavanaugh, for your time and knowledge, sir. There you have Mr. Jim Kavanaugh, political analyst and blogger, all the way from New York. Thank you, sir. Now, continuing with the rest of the news, Palestinian officials in Gaza say Israel has bombed or bombarded the territory with more than 45,000 missiles and giant bombs weighing more than 65,000 tons. According to a statement by the Gaza government office, some of the bombs used by the regime contained 2,000 pounds of explosives. It added that in terms of weight and power, the explosives used against Gaza are equivalent to three nuclear bombs like the one dropped by the US on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. The statement noted that two-thirds of the bombs and missiles used by Israel are unguided and imprecise, which are used indiscriminately against civilian targets. The office said using such bombs is a clear and explicit violation of international law and various international conventions by the Israeli regime. Iran's president has once again vowed a decisive punishment for masterminds and perpetrators of the terrorist bombings that killed scores of people in the Iranian city of Kerman. Ebrahim Raisi was speaking in a phone conversation with his Serbian counterpart, Alexander Vucic. He said such cowardly acts will not stop the Iranian nation from pursuing its goal of fighting oppression, injustice, and tyranny. Raisi emphasized that those involved in this heinous crime will have no safe haven, even if they are supported by world powers. Condemning the terrorist act, Vucic expressed hope that the masterminds and perpetrators of the crime will swiftly face justice. In an earlier phone call with President of Turkmenistan, Serdar Berdi Muhammadov, Raisi stressed that those responsible for plotting this terrorist act will face a resolute response. Berdi Muhammadov, for his part, condemned the terror attacks and conveyed condolences to the Iranian government and nation. Thousands of people gathered in Tehran's Grand Mosalla to commemorate Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani's fourth martyrdom anniversary. High-ranking political and military figures also attended the ceremony along with foreign dignitaries. Kisumish Ahmadi has the details.
Huge crowds gathered in Tehran's Grand Mosalla to commemorate the fourth martyrdom anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, pledging to follow in his footsteps. High-ranking Iranian officials and a number of foreign dignitaries were also present. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi addressed the ceremony, reiterating that the presence of huge crowds in Tehran and different cities across the country commemorating the martyrdom anniversary of the top commander is a testimony to the fact that his legacy lives on and his school of thought is bearing fruit, not just in Iran, but in the entire region, with many people inspired by the concept of resistance as defined by Haj Qasem.
He's a role model for our society. He's a hero in Iran and in the Muslim world. He's the hero who fought against terrorism in West Asia. He always defended the oppressed. That is why he always stood by Palestine. He stood by Lebanon. He stood by Yemen. He would always find an opportunity in every threat. There is a lot that we can learn from him. He was the man who formed a united and active resistance front in the region. He made all the oppressed people in the region believe that they are capable and strong.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani redefined resistance, breathing new air into the resistance front. And this is considered the most fundamental part of Haj Qasem's legacy, and the reason why so many people in the region, and particularly Palestinians, look up to him, and also why he is known as the martyr of Al-Quds. The top commander's legacy lives on, with more and more people taking part in his martyrdom anniversary every year.
On the fourth martyrdom anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, huge crowds gathered at Tehran's Grand Mosalla to pledge allegiance to the top commander and the values he stood up for. Kisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
The Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it has carried out fresh attacks against American troops in Syria. The resistance group said it hit two U.S. military bases in Syria using drones. The first attack targeted an air base hosting American troops near the Al-Omar oil field. The second one hit the U.S. Rukban camp. The group said the attacks were in response to the U.S. presence in the region and the American-Israeli genocidal war on Gaza. The operation comes hours after a U.S. drone attack on the headquarters of the Popular Mobilization Units near the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. Three people, including a commander of the Najaba Resistance Movement, were killed. Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani strongly condemned the attack, calling it a dangerous escalation and a violation of the country's sovereignty. The premier said Baghdad holds the U.S.-led international coalition responsible for the attack. The Iraqi parliament members have also called for the expulsion of the American ambassador to the Arab country. Meanwhile, tensions remain high in areas along Lebanon's southern border over Israel's ongoing onslaught against the Gaza Strip. The Israeli occupation forces have struck several areas in southern Lebanon, including the town of Al-Khiyam, which was bombed with internationally banned phosphorus munitions. This comes after Israel's deadly overnight raids on Nakura that killed five people. In retaliation, the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah says it has struck a contingent of Israeli soldiers in Al-Jalil, inflicting losses on the regime forces. The area along Lebanon's southern border has been the scene of exchanges of fire between Hezbollah and Israel since the regime began its onslaught on the Gaza Strip on October the 7th. Hezbollah says its attacks are a response to the regime's genocide of Palestinians. And with that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
With few hospitals functioning in Gaza, because the Zionist regime has bombed virtually all of them, there is desperate shortage of medicines and even electricity. The case of children with smashed limbs is extremely painful. There is no anesthesia in the few hospitals that are still functioning. Children's limbs have to be amputated without anesthesia. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International Road, more than 21,000 civilians have been killed in Gaza by the Zionist regime war criminals since October 7th. They can be considered lucky. After all, their suffering is over, even if they have left behind grieving relatives. Among the dead are more than 8,000 children. And there are at least 7,000 Palestinians, many of them women and children, buried under the rubble of collapsed buildings. There is no heavy equipment to lift the huge concrete slabs to find out if they are still alive. There is another aspect of their suffering that needs to be told. Under relentless Israeli regime bombardment, many children have suffered horrific injuries. These range from deep wounds to their bodies to badly smashed limbs that have to be amputated. With few hospitals functioning in Gaza, because the Zionist regime has bombed virtually all of them, There is desperate shortage of medicines and even electricity. The case of children with smashed limbs is extremely painful. There is no anesthesia in the few hospitals that are still functioning. Children's limbs have to be amputated without anesthesia. Some 1,000 children have had their limbs amputated without anesthesia in Gaza since October 7th, the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, has said. One can imagine the pain these children must have endured and continue to endure. They have suffered triple pain, loss of parents in Israeli regime bombings, personal injuries, some of which, especially to the limbs, are so severe that they have to be amputated. And finally, because of the Zionist regime's destruction of most hospitals and total siege of Gaza, amputations take place without anesthesia. The screams of children being held down while surgeons amputate their limbs is unbearable for most people. Naturally, young children cry for their parents under such circumstances, but they are already dead. Their relatives try to distract them. Take the case of 4-year-old Ahmad. His family home was bombed twice. He lost both his parents. He was badly injured and both his legs had to be amputated. He constantly cries for his mother and father. His uncle, who has now become his guardian, tries to distract him and make him forget about his parents. How could a 4-year-old child forget his parents? At this tender age, they are his entire world. Gaza's doctors continued their struggle in these most trying circumstances. Nurse Abu Ahmad Hossanein recalled how he stitched up the head wound of a little girl without anesthesia in Ash-Sharif Hospital as she screamed, "Mommy, Mommy!" He described this as one of the worst moments of his career. The case of a Gaza doctor is even more painful. He had to amputate his child's legs without anesthesia. After the amputation, the child died of pain as his father watched helplessly. The Zionist regime war criminals are directly responsible for these barbaric acts. They are amply supplied by the United States that has provided these savages with military weapons to continue the genocide of the civilian population of Gaza. The Ministry of Health in Gaza says that nearly 70% of casualties are children and women. The death toll has surpassed 21,000. The actual figure is much higher. Nearly 55,000 people have been injured, according to Health Ministry spokesperson Ashraf Al-Ghodra. There is also acute shortage of food, clean drinking water, and other essential commodities of life. Meanwhile, Middle East Eye wrote, more than 1,000 children in Gaza have had one or more limbs amputated since the Zionist regime's onslaught on the besieged area began on October 7th, with many undergoing the procedure without anesthesia, the United Nations Children's Fund UNICEF revealed recently. James Elder, a UNICEF spokesperson, reported that children in Gaza were enduring 10 weeks of hell and not one of them can escape. Elder, who has recently returned from the besieged enclave, reported that the few remaining hospitals in Gaza are overwhelmed with children and their parents, all of whom are bearing the ghastly wounds of war. He said that many of them were child amputees. As a parent of a critically sick child told me, our situation is pure misery. I don't know if we will make it through this, he said. Due to the total blockade imposed by the Zionist regime on the enclave and a dearth of anesthesia, electricity, and running water, health workers are forced to perform these surgeries in on hygienic conditions without painkillers. It's not as if there is a natural disaster preventing anesthesia from entering Gaza. Palestinian Children's Relief Fund, PCRF founder Steve Sosby said in an interview with Democracy Now, he said, "It's absolutely unimaginable that this is happening in our modern world." He added that the number of child amputees was likely to grow because a lot of these kids have significant injuries that mean they will need amputations in the coming weeks and months. He said, not only were they amputated without anesthesia, but many of them were amputated in a very quick fashion. Around half of my operating list, which was around 10 to 12 cases every day, were children, said Dr. Ghassan Abu Sita, a London-based surgeon who traveled to Gaza to treat patients amid the ongoing Israeli onslaught, said in a press conference in November. He recalled, "One night at Al Ahli Hospital, I performed amputations on 6 children." In an interview with Middle East Eye, Sita said that having to perform these operations without anesthesia was one of the most difficult things I've had to do in my career. Prior to the current war on Gaza, 12% of Palestinian children aged 2 to 17 faced one or more functional difficulties, while 21% of households in Gaza include at least one member with physical or mental disabilities. According to PCRF, prior to the current hostilities, Gaza was already suffering from amputee crisis. The ongoing Israeli regime siege on the enclave, which tightly controls the flow of people, medical equipment, and pharmaceuticals in and out of the area, means timely evacuation of the wounded to better-equipped hospitals in the occupied West Bank is often impossible. The barriers to healthcare access are such that the UN defined individuals in need of medical referrals as a vulnerable group within the Palestinian population. According to PCRF, many Palestinians are at risk of osteomyelitis or bone infection following injury if medical treatment is delayed. The dearth of medical resources and restrictions on movement in the besieged strip means that many treatable injuries require amputation.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. I'm Umay Biha Mukhtar, your host on IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. Joining us today is Sister Salma Khalfan, a respected Islamic researcher, and she will enlighten us on the concept of hijab as guided by the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. Assalamu alaikum and welcome, Sister Salma Khalfan.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
Thank you so much for being here. So in the previous episode, we were talking about what Ayatollah Khamenei had to say about the situation of women and their hijab at the time of the Pahlavi rule. And we discussed a lot about it. It was very interesting. And towards the end, you mentioned it was very hard for women to preserve their hijab and dignity, especially in educational environments. Can you enlighten us more about this?
Yes, Ayatollah Khamenei has said that it was very difficult for a woman to also walk in the streets of Tehran and some other cities while she was wearing even partial hijab. It's sad, isn't it?
Very sad.
And it shows that women at that time also wanted that for themselves, the hijab. They were modest. They were a group of women who were going out in the city. Why the streets of Tehran or other cities? It's because they were going out to pursue something, to work or to go towards learning or education or universities, whatever it was. But they were wearing partial hijab. That even it was difficult for them. Reza Shah, he had really strongly decided to go against this. This shows that it was just a stubborn kind of attitude that he had, just to show the Muslims that they were not right and to show the West that you are right and we are puppets at your hands. So this shows that women at that time also were pious and wanted modesty for themselves. And also it shows that they wanted to pursue their knowledge, their education. And that's why they were out in the streets, right?
Yeah.
And this shows also that Reza Shah was so stubborn. He wanted to, actually show the West that we are adopting your ideas. Like it's a way of saying that, okay, you have some anwata atar, we are puppets at your hands. And that's not a very good thing, yeah? It's not a dignified thing for himself. In the long run.
Yeah,
what dignity did it leave for him now? Look, he's no more.
There's
right?
just a handful of people who somehow...
Even under the rule of the Shah,
this
policy itself, did it leave some dignified memories for him?
No.
Zillat.
Yeah.
Just, disgrace. That's it.
Definitely.
They had made it almost, Ayatollah Khamenei continues, they had made it almost impossible for women to also acquire knowledge in this country, that is Iran. You know, they were just trying to prove it to the women that either this or that. Okay? So if you want knowledge, everybody would like to acquire knowledge. There were also people at that time who would love to have become doctors and everything. So it was giving them a choice that was very hard to choose, you know, from what to take and what to leave. So, of course, there were some exceptions, but it was not possible for most women to enter some scholarly areas unless they agreed to give up the hijab and the Islamic piety and dignity. It shows that Ayatollah Khamenei says, unless they give up their hijab and the Islamic piety, means the hijab is one of the criteria of piety for a woman and her dignity. So it's very important in this case, in now day and age also, if you go and see women, if they want to get a shield for themselves, that protection, then they should observe this hijab and start, refraining from this kind of copying the cultural ideas of the West and mimicking their ideas.
Definitely. I feel like it kind of gives you this feeling of self-respect as well. That, you know, I'm not defined by what I...
Oh, like a different...
Show.
I'm different. I'm unique.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I feel like, he wants that for us. In fact, Allah is, of course, all the commands of... is none other than according to the Quran and the Sunnah. So that's what he wants from us. That dignified look... that uniqueness of a woman, that woman appears like a shining star, because woman plays the central role in the life of a man also. You know, like, Om, they call her the source.
Yeah.
You know, that's so important. She's the source, actually. She brings up the society in the long run.
So we're just going to, pause briefly, and inshallah we'll resume in a moment. Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we've been discussing about hijab at the time of the Pahlavi rule. And it's been very interesting, especially because we have been trying to understand that time and how hijab had a role to play and how it was kind of denied from the women. And if we reflect it to the times today, we realize that, you know, if this happens again, we're kind of denying that, you know, the right of hijab again, and we're going in towards immodesty. And we have seen how at that time the society got so corrupt. We don't want that to happen again. And I think that's the main reason why we're discussing this topic today.
Absolutely.
As well. And we're trying to understand that how, you know, the Western powers don't give infinite wisdom to us. They don't. It is Islam that gives us. It is Allah who gives us this. And we have scholars and our Ayatollah Khomeini and Khamenei who have been trying to emulate those concepts to us. And I think it's very necessary for us to, you know, keep that in mind.
Absolutely.
So what about the social progress of the Iranian women with the code of Islamic dressing? I'm sure our leader has loads to say on that, please.
Yes, absolutely, he does. Ayatollah Khamenei says that after the revolution, that is the Inqilab Islami, Islam and Imam Khomeini placed women as the center of political activities and gave the flag of the revolution to women. They encouraged women. Our women stepped into the area of, and at the same time, managed to preserve their hijab, their dignity, their chastity, their faith and piety. So hijab lets us do this, you know. Hijab helps us, you know, like preserve our dignity, chastity, faith and piety. Nobody, like this is a very good statement, I love it, when Ayatollah Khamenei says, nobody has done a greater favor to Iranian and Muslim women than this, you know, like giving this encouragement to come out and, you know, progress in the social field also with the chastity, with the hijab, with the modest dress and with faith and piety, of course, in the long run. As we saw during the revolution and as we can see now, says His Eminence, when Muslim women go back to their nature, they can make a great difference. You know, like as far as their nature is concerned, in the social area, they can really create an impact.
Definitely,
that's what Ayatollah Khamenei wants to say. Thankfully, we have many knowledgeable women in various fields, diligent and gifted female students, highly educated women and prominent women doctors. In the Islamic Republic, various scientific fields are dominated by Iranian ladies. They preserve their morality, observe hijab, raise their children, because women in their fitrah, you know, want a family and they don't neglect their children.
Yeah.
So they raise their children in the Islamic manner, and whoever does, you know, according to the Islamic principles, will of course lay importance in raising their children and the Islamically that too, and take care of their husbands as well, preserve their family, and at the same time they engage in what? Political and scientific activities.
Yeah.
So it is completely possible for a woman with an Islamic character to fully realize her potential in an Islamic environment.
We can see like how much it's flourishing.
Yeah, Islamic environment is completely a possible thing for a woman to flourish and keep away from corruption, luxury, lifestyles, modeling, humiliation, part-time display of beauty, all these things, you know. So
kind of showing off and like you're reducing yourself to commodities where you have to, you're there to show your beauty.
And the sad thing is, you know what, the women know that they're commodities and they're very proud of it. That we are commodity that is best-selling commodity. They don't know that it's against their fitrah. They're doing the worst injustice to themselves,
definitely.
Right? When they completely realize this, you know, and they accept it and they like it, that shows they've covered their fitrahs. And it's like sometimes it's sadly a point of no return. And that's why we see big actresses, you know, like in the West, dying and still beautifying themselves and not returning to the original fitrah, not realizing that, oh, what I did was just a waste. No, they're proud of themselves. And people who follow them are so proud of them, you know, that such and such actress was this. She looked like this in 1984 and 1985 she was like this. Until 2023 she looked like this. Look how old she looks. And she died after that. Okay,
so
now
successful.
Yeah, let's be silent and just remember her. That's it.
We also have those kind of women who, for example, there was one of them who was a singer apparently, and before she died she wrote that, I wish I had lived my life in another way. I wish I had got a family. I wish I had children. It's like then it gets too late and you feel like so resentful that you've wasted kind of your life.
Exactly.
The purpose you've come for, you're no longer.
Yeah, it's even very rare that a person like this would have realized.
Yeah.
It showed that she was starting to read or to get enlightenment somehow.
So, we're just going to take a short break and we'll continue shortly.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we're discussing with Sister Salma Khalfan about the social progress of the Iranian women with this code of Islamic dressing and what our leader has said about that. I wanted to ask, what is the message of a faithful Iranian woman to the world according to the words of our Islamic leader? And what should be the message?
Yes. Ayatollah Khamenei reiterates that from the social level of promotion of women and how they are reacting to it and how they want the whole world to know about the progress that they are making.
Yeah.
And that they should not lag behind too. It's like a tabligh, you know, that they are doing. That don't forget this. So Ayatollah Khamenei says that Iranian women, especially those who have managed to make scholarly achievements in different fields within the framework of Islam, Islamic teachings and hijab, should convince women across the world that acquiring knowledge is not synonymous with immorality.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be accompanied with immorality.
Definitely.
You can acquire knowledge, but with chastity together. By performing it, of course, yeah? So when you come out in the platform wearing your hijab and proving that point, people will see that how can she do it, I cannot do. France will see, how can this woman become such a successful doctor or a surgeon and I'm here not allowed to wear my scarf and pursue knowledge? No, there has to be something wrong, right?
True.
How can they say that you can't do this and then because then you can't, be famous in education? If this woman could reach so much, like, atop that everybody comes to, pay her a visit, regarding her field and take benefit from her. So why shouldn't I even adopt this policy of modesty, right?
Yeah.
So they have to convince all women that lack of commitment to moral standards in their relationship with men is not a prerequisite for acquiring knowledge. It's not like when you go and sit in near a boy and have a co-educational school, that's when you'll become more clever. No, it has nothing to do. It's not a prerequisite for acquiring knowledge. It is possible to observe all these moral standards of Islam and achieve highly scholarly positions. There'll be so much more barakat too, right? Because of, following that innate fitrat, innate nature of yourself, especially a woman. A Western woman changed her religion because of what? Hijab. Why hijab? It gave her freedom.
She understood
the truth. She understood. She appreciated.
And I think that if we look at the situation right now, what with all the sanctions and all the, money struggle that Iran is facing, yet it's progressing so much. It's really it's very amazing to me personally. I feel other countries say, but even though Iran is, going up, but it's not going maybe as high as it could be if really hijab is and all this and women, we are empowering women. But no, it is. But they are kind of limiting our hands. They're closing our hands because of all these limitations with the sanctions and everything. Otherwise, Iran could even go further. The people can also even go further. But because that's of right. all of these things that they themselves are limiting us, it's
preventing. And because of the faith of Ayatollah Khamenei, he knows there's a wisdom behind it.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
He should not stop working.
Yeah.
And women should not also stop working and feel this is the end of the time now. Now, there's nothing left in Iran. No, there's so much progress everywhere. You see tits and bits of progress going on.
True.
It's not a small wonder, what with the faith.
Yeah, I really admire the people of Iran, honestly. And I feel like they're very special. And inshallah, we can also be as strong as they are in these times that they're facing.
Inshallah.
Thank you so much, Sister Salma Khalfan, for your valuable time. And we hope to see you in the next episode.
Inshallah.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Stagflation and weak economic growth have reportedly led to a gap in living standards valued at £8,300 or well over $10,000. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, more than a decade of economic stagnation has left British households 25% poorer than their peers in such countries as France and Germany, according to the latest research, which was published recently. The study by the Resolution Foundation and the Centre for Economic Performance at the London School of Economics shows UK living standards are 3% below their peak in 2020 and are continuing to fall. The report said, were Britain to close the average income and inequality gap to its peers of Australia, Canada, France, Germany, and the Netherlands, the typical household would be 25% or £8,300 better off, with income gains of 37% for the poorest households. Researchers have called for decisive actions to increase productivity by reducing the wealth gap between Britain's cities, championing services exports and boosting the public investment. According to the research titled Economy 2030 Inquiry, the UK has now seen 15 years of relative decline, with productivity grown at half the rate seen across other advanced economies. Britain was catching up with more productive states like France, Germany, and the US back in 1990s and early 2000s. Economy 2030 Inquiry explains, but lagged behind in mid-2000s, with relative performance declining ever since. The study calculated that the downturn has cost the average worker in Britain £10,700 a year in lost income due to the slow pace of real wage growth, with about 9 million younger employees who have never worked in an economy with sustained average wage rises. The research proposed that government raise capital spending to 3% of GDP to close the living standards gap with European peers, and that it starts increasing its funding through domestic savings and not borrowing from abroad. The report concluded, if UK business investment had matched the average of France, Germany, and the US since 2008, our GDP would be nearly 4% higher today, boosting wages by around £1,250 a year. According to Guardian, British workers are missing out on £10,700 a year as living standards fall. Report by Resolution Foundation and LSE calls for economic strategy rethink after 15 years of relative decline. British workers are missing out on £10,700 a year after more than a decade of weak economic growth and high inequality, according to a major report warning that UK living standards are falling behind comparable rich nations. In a damning report on the economy, the Resolution Foundation and the London School of Economics Centre for Economic Performance called for an urgent rethink of economic strategy after 15 years of relative decline. It said a living standards gap worth £8,300 had opened up between typical households in Britain and their average peers in Australia, Canada, France, Germany, and the Netherlands, and blamed the toxic combination of low growth and high inequality. The result of a three-year inquiry by a group of the nation's top academics, business people, and policymakers, the study warned that a generation of younger adults was being failed in particular, with 9 million having never worked in an economy with sustained average wage rises. Poor households in Britain were now £4,300 worse off than their French and German counterparts, leaving them struggling to cope in the cost of living crisis. According to The Telegraph, Britain only rich nation where food prices are rising by more than 10%. Inflation measure remains in double digits in just three other countries, says OECD. Also, Reuters reported the British public's expectations for inflation over the medium to long term, which are closely watched by the Bank of England, rose to a five-month high in October, according to a survey published recently. Inflation expectations in 5 to 10 years' time picked up to 3.5% in October from 3.3% in September, the survey by US Bank Citi and polling from YouGov showed. While British consumer price inflation dropped sharply in October to a two-year low of 4.6%, Citi said the rise in public inflation expectations probably reflected higher petrol prices and showed that the BOE could not be complacent about price risks. Public expectations for inflation in 12-month time were stable at 4.2%, with compressed corporate margins risking a more persistent period of elevated price growth. Both fiscal and monetary policy should remain cautious, Citi economist Benjamin Nabarro wrote in a note to clients. Citi trimmed its growth forecast for Britain following tax cuts announced by Finance Minister Jeremy Hunt last month, partly because it expected the fiscal stimulus would delay the point at which the BOE began to cut interest rates.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.